We are back with the paper by Brown and Duguid, the idea of communities of practice and organizational learning. And here we are encountering an argument that is stylistically super different from Cohen and Leventhal, and also kind of relies on a completely different kind of data, completely different underlying understanding of what knowledge is, the understanding of knowledge and innovation as something that is inseparably linked to working practices. Is, I think, fundamentally important, especially as we think about contextual ambidexterity, right? The idea that innovation can arise kind of harmoniously, inevitably out of everyday working practices. That kind of understanding of knowledge is going to be significant, especially as we get into the discussion of user innovation that we'll return to in later classes. And you will actually, if you read some of my own work, you'll see that this is an understanding that informs a lot of my thinking about the management of innovation processes. I'm full disclosure, much more interested and excited about their work than I am in Cohen and Leventhal's. But that's just so you can interpret my interpretation in that light. What Cohen or what Brown and Duguid would like to achieve here is in pretty much in the article's subtitle, right? To provide a unified view of work, learning, and innovation. And the way that they're going to do that is by drawing on an ethnographic study of technician work in Xerox. That's that paper was done, or that ethnographic work was done by Julian Orr and is described in his totally readable book. It's called Talking About Machines. It's published in 1996. And then it's going to be based on the theory and the concept of communities and practice. On their way to making their argument, on the way to creating that unified view of learning, they're going to spend a lot of time thinking about what practice really is and to distinguish between formal and informal descriptions of work. They are also going to make some distinctions between the actual and the abstract. Between canonical and non-canonical solutions, and their argument kind of put in very short form, and I'm going to quote, through their constant adapting to changing membership and changing circumstances, evolving communities of practice are significant sites of innovating, right? That, for good reason, is a not totally uncontroversial point of view in the innovation literature, in the sense that the kind of innovation that they're describing is what many people would call highly incremental and relevant primarily during periods of incremental change, much the same way that some people talk about contextual ambidexterity. But that's basically their key ideas, right? These communities of practice with changing membership and in adapting to changing circumstances are producing a substantial share of organizational innovation, right? So their analysis is going to begin with trying to develop an understanding of what work actually is as something that operates on two levels, right? It's something that's described, something that there's a formal account of, and something that gets done, which is often much more informal. They use kind of a map metaphor for described work, and they're going to argue that work as done differs pretty dramatically from the described, much in the same way that the landscape and the reality on the ground is very different from the image on the map. That may seem really obvious, but in organizational practice it's not, right? So as they put it in the paper, they say many organizations are willing to assume that complex tasks can be successfully mapped onto a set of simple tayloristic canonical steps that can be followed without need of significant understanding or insight, and thus without a need of significant investment in training or skilled technicians. But, as Bourdieu, Suchman, and Orr show, actual practice inevitably involves tricky interpolations between abstract accounts and situated demands. Ors rep skills, right? For instance, are most evident in the improvised strategies they developed to cope with the clash between prescriptive documentation and the sophisticated yet unpredictable machines they work with. Nonetheless, in the corporation's eyes, practices that deviate from the canonical are, by definition, deviant practices. Through a reliance on canonical descriptions, to the extent of overlooking even their own non-canonical improvisations, managers develop a conceptual outlook that cannot comprehend the importance of non-canonical practices. People are typically viewed as performing their jobs according to formal job descriptions, despite the fact that daily evidence points to the contrary. They are held accountable to the map, not to road conditions. Right. So what does this mean? And for the employees that Orr describes, and Orr being the ethnographer describing work at Xerox, he looked at the people who repair Xerox's copiers when they are installed amongst customers, and show how very fine and how very complex it actually is to do that kind of work, right? So, and in making that description of all this local improvisation, he kind of points out all the issues and problems that you have when you believe in standard descriptions of work and in the descriptions of manuals, right? So firstly, there's going to be, at least in Orr and consequently also in Brown and Dewitt's thinking, there's going to be just a tremendous abyss between real-time work and the work that leaders think is being carried out, right? Second, work actually becomes harder. It's hard to fix these copiers. It's a technically challenging thing, but at the same time, you have to navigate an organization that thinks it's easy, right? So, as they put it in the paper, the inadequacies of the corporation's directive approach actually make a rep's work more difficult to achieve, and thus perversely demands more, not less, improvisational skill. Right. And interestingly, as a third point, right, employees are actually much more competent than they appear, and they're much more difficult to train than it appears when you think of work as the map and not the landscape, right? So, as they put it, an ostensible downskilling and actual upskilling therefore proceed simultaneously. The employees acquire more skills while at the same time appearing from the outside as less competent and as needing fewer skills, right? Now that the formal organization does not take particular care to recognize the complexity of work, what it does is that it displaces the task of dealing with complexity to the employees. And the way that employees tend to handle this is through cooperation. Although formally, according to the organization, they work alone, where work problems get solved through continuous sharing of stories and constructions of how particular situations are best understood to be both distinctive and typical, right? So this kind of problem solving is not something that happens in the minds of individuals, but in professional communities, right? What Brown and Dewitt, with the term that they borrow from two learning theorists called communities of practice, a community of practice is an informal grouping of individuals who share some kind of practice. In this context, a particular professional practice of repairing photocopiers, but that in principle could be any kind of practice. Now, such groups are not something that is easily planned for, but rather something that kind of emerges organically as work gets done, and often emerges without any particular kind of managerial intervention. You can kind of say very much with Brown and Dewitt's blessing that they arise because they're necessary for work to be carried out, right? In fact, without these emergent self-organized communities, many organizations would simply not be able to learn in any particularly effective way, nor would they be able to improvise and adapt, right? These communities of practice are necessary because they form the framework in which situational learning and learning by doing emerges, right? Getting into work, learning to do work, whether it's through apprenticeship or knowing an expert or something in between, is a prerequisite for having a well-functioning practice, because context plays such a substantial role in how knowledge gets applied, right? So it's never just about the task. It's always about the task in its particular context. And that almost always inevitably calls for some element of learning on site in the particular situation, and some kind of adaptation and improvisation around it. And that kind of learning is not only professional, it's also deeply social. Learning depends not only on having problems to work on, problems to solve, but also on having people that you can share the experience of a task with, and such that you can qualify your solution together with others. As such, learning is going to be really closely linked to ongoing discussions and the development of group membership and identity and self-understanding. And in that sense, the learning that appears is going to be much more profoundly social and sociological and organizational than what you sometimes see it described as, right? It's definitely a much more complex understanding of knowledge than what Cohen and Leventhal are espousing, right? And it's clearly going to be problematic for effective learning if you don't have that complex understanding of what learning is, because then you're going to be inevitably introducing another layer of complexity for workers that they have to adapt to, right? What's important to understand about communities of practice is not only that they're sites where people learn something. It's also that they're sites where new ideas and practices arise. I'm going to quote a little bit. Right. Communities of practice, like the reps, continue to develop a rich, fluid, non-canonical worldview to bridge the gap between their organization's static, canonical view and the challenge of changing practice. This process of development is inherently innovative, right? So in other words, they're doing a lot of exploration while formally tasked only with kind of exploitative work, right? Because learning is this ongoing thing, a lot of the practice that gets developed can be highly invisible because it kind of flows within the community, but it can also have this appearance of being somewhat negative, being this undesirable deviant activity, right? You can kind of think about that. Why would organizations think of learning and adaptation as undesirable? Well, if you think about it through the prism of exploitation, you can actually see that the whole point of exploitation is to avoid variation. And what communities of practices do essentially is creating variation, to creating an increased space of opportunities for the members of the community to solve problems in varied ways and not in standardized ways. Right? So in that sense, the pursuit of efficiency is precisely about minimizing the variation that in Abernathy's terms are keeping the organization from becoming very well defined and from working very efficiently. Unfortunately, that push for standardization, that push to minimize variation, is going to make it very difficult for individuals to learn and adapt in their everyday work, right? Brown and Dewitt kind of end up with an interesting connection back to the ambidexterity debate. when they argue that big organizations need to have this kind, end up having to have these difficulties of innovation, right? Just much like how Adler argues that broadly distributed innovation can take place in bureaucratic organizations when bureaucracy is enabling, Brown and Dewitt argue that large organizations and the huge gap that they create between work as it's described and work as it's done can be a source of necessary improvisation and thus innovation, right? They write, and I'm going to quote a little bit, they're talking about large organizations here. Such organizations are uniquely positioned to generate innovative discontinuities incrementally, thereby reducing the disruption of the periodic radical reorganization. In this sense, because organizations are so large, they can create these discrepancies between how work is meant to be done and the challenges that people face. And that gap, that discrepancy, can prompt a need for innovating, right? So inadvertently, you can have these perturbations almost when canonical practices, canonical work descriptions meet non-canonical practices that prompt workers to having to have to innovate, right? The problem, of course, with that is that much like how you needed a very good sense of the practice that you're intervening in when you're introducing deliberate perturbations, you also need kind of a deep appreciation for the value of communities of practice if you want that variation to be generative, right? If you want that gap between the formalized description and the actual work practice to generate some valuable learning and not just frustration, you need to somehow get those communities of practice into a space where what they do is valorized and not seen as this obstacle to efficiency, right? Brown and Dewitt kind of put this quite nicely when they say, an organization whose core is aware that it is the synergistic aggregate of agile, semi-autonomous, self-constituting communities and not a brittle monolith is likely to be capable of extensive frame bending well beyond the conventional breaking point. Right? So basically, if you have an organization that appreciates the variation that communities of practice produce, you can have this foundation for a very contextual ambidexterity, right? Okay. What's important in the big picture to understand, though, is that Brown and Dewitt present a fundamentally different understanding of organizations than what we're used to, right? The whole idea of organizations that we get from kind of modern management practices is one in which managers make decisions and they coordinate. Managers are making the plans. Managers are choosing between the appropriate kind of solutions to implement. Brown and Dewitt present a version where the decisions that get made in organizations are much more widely distributed, and the kind of organization that comes out of that is one that's very emergent. Right? In their version, planning and decisions are something that everyone's kind of a part of within this community-based framework. And so information and knowledge are going to be very widely distributed. And the ability to act on that distributed knowledge is going to be part of what allows organizations to even function. Right? Okay. That's all I have for this class. Next lesson, we're going to talk about how innovation gets managed. We're going to talk about stage gate management models that typically get associated with Robert Cooper. And then we're going to talk about the management accounting processes that surround innovation projects. And then we're going to talk about the idea of bootlegging in R&D work. And that's going to be great. I look forward to seeing you in class. Enjoy your further preparations.